Satire in the spotlight again. This is The World. I'm Marco Werman. Questions about satire and Islam after the attack against a Prophet Muhammad cartoons event in the Dallas area. Before the event, local Muslims were trying to ignore it.
To be honest with you, I was actually throwing a football with my kids in the park. I had even forgotten that the event was taking place yesterday.
The Dallas attack again raises a question: what's acceptable to satirize and what is not? Even Doonesbury's creator is weighing in.
Gary Trudeau says satire has always comforted the afflicted while afflicting the comfortable. Satire punches up, not down.
Plus, a Syrian-American rapper finds a through line in his musical work.
Beneath all the political posturing, beneath all the conspiracy theories and all the proxy wars that are taking place, there's very real human suffering.
That's ahead on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Far From the Madding Crowd, the new film based on Thomas Hardy's classic love story, starring Carey Mulligan, Matthias Schoenaerts, Michael Sheen, and Tom Sturridge, in select theaters now. And by TIAA CREF, a financial services company helping to create financial outcomes that matter. Learn more at TIAA.org.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. After the Charlie Hebdo massacre in Paris last January, how many of us wondered if that could happen here? Speculative, maybe even a far-fetched question then, but not today, not after what happened last night in Garland, Texas. We don't yet have all the facts, but this is what we do know. Two gunmen drove up to a building in Garland where a contest featuring cartoons of Islam's Prophet Muhammad had been taking place. They opened fire and then police shot them dead. In a moment, we'll look at this odd balance between free speech and using it to insult religion. But first, this incident has put a spotlight on the group that organized the event, the American Freedom Defense Initiative, or AFDI. They call themselves a human rights organization dedicated to free speech, religious liberty, and individual rights. But Mark Potok from the Southern Poverty Law Center calls them something else, a hate group.
They are an organization co-founded by a woman named Pam Geller. Geller is probably the most visible and flamboyant of the anti-Muslim ideologues that we have in this country.
So what seems to be the AFDI's main concern regarding Islam?
Well, Geller, in her own words, has described Islam not as a religion, but rather an extreme ideology. She's called it the most radical and extreme ideology on the face of the earth, and that there is a secret plan to make the United States part of a gigantic Muslim caliphate.
What do you make of the aim of this cartoon contest down in Texas, drawing the Prophet Muhammad? I mean, that's
well,
an provocation. Expression of free speech, isn't it?
Well, sure. I defend Pamela Geller's right to be a racist and a bigot. She is allowed that under the American First Amendment, and I think that's as it should be. At the same time, let's call her what she is. She's a provocateur. She specializes in this kind of thing. She has posted cartoons of the Prophet Muhammad on her website, very ugly cartoons, in the past, and it kind of goes on from there. I mean, she really does specialize in defaming not simply radical Islamists, but Islam in general and Muslims as a whole.
So back in January, we saw the attack at the Paris magazine Charlie Hebdo, and its supporters claimed they're protected by freedom of expression in how they portray religion. Rightly so, many would argue. When you come right down to it, would you draw a distinction between the AFDI and a publication like Charlie Hebdo? Is there a difference?
Yes, I would draw a distinction.
And what is that?
The reason is this. I saw recently an analysis of what Charlie Hebdo really targeted. And a very, very tiny percentage of their cartoons and commentary, satirical commentary, have really been aimed at Muslims and Islam. Charlie Hebdo, in fact, spent much more of its energy directed at the targets that satire is usually directed to, which are essentially the rich and the powerful. Geller's organization is quite different. She, in fact, is picking on what in this country is a real minority and a minority under siege.
Charlie Hebdo has done that too, though. I mean, they're obviously insulting people for perhaps different reasons, but I mean, it is hard to draw a distinction.
Well, I think it's hard to draw. Well, look, I don't think there's much of a distinction in the sense to be drawn. And, you know, the distinction I was trying to draw between Charlie Hebdo and Geller's organization is that Charlie Hebdo doesn't really specialize in the mocking of vulnerable and small minorities, although they certainly have done that. So I just think it's a different in tone that I'm trying to describe. In terms of free speech, those are really absolute questions. And in my opinion, and the opinion of SPLC, Charlie Hebdo, just as Pam Geller, have the right to say these things legally. It doesn't mean they're in good taste. It doesn't mean that they're enviable things to say. It certainly doesn't mean they're right, but they do have that right under the Constitution.
That's Mark Potok with the Southern Poverty Law Center. The event that was attacked yesterday in Garland has been widely described as anti-Muslim, and it's worth noting that it took place in a part of Texas with a sizable Muslim population.
It really is tens of thousands. So I would say that if you include the entire Dallas-Fort Worth community, I don't have an exact number, but it's definitely over 100,000, well over 100,000.
Omar Suleiman is a resident scholar at the Valley Ranch Islamic Center in Irving. That's just outside Dallas. He's also an ordained imam. Suleiman says that ahead of the event in Garland, local Islamic leaders had decided not to get worked up about it.
Our community ignored it altogether. In fact, I would say that the majority of Muslims forgot that that event was even taking place. You know, I was, to be honest with you, I was actually throwing a football with my kids in the park when I got a text message, and I had even forgotten that the event was taking place yesterday.
Mm-hmm. So ignoring it was a strategic move on your part. I suppose other activists in the Dallas area also encourage people to just not go, to ignore it.
Absolutely. It's not good for our community in Dallas as a whole. We don't want this. We don't want this being fought out over here. I mean, and it's worth noting that this is not only one of the largest Muslim communities in the country, it's also a very well-integrated community. I mean, we have never had any issues of that sort in the greater community here. The people that came out to this event were about 100 or so, and the vast majority of them were not from Dallas. This is a traveling circus of sorts, and you know they try to get people out. I mean, this is exactly what they wanted, and Pamela Geller wasted no time taking to her blog to say, this is a war, this is a war.
Mr. Suleiman, I got to say, coloring the backdrop to this event is this anti-Sharia bill going through the Texas State House. And I gather there's been some controversy in Irving, Texas over that. What's going on there?
Well, sadly, I mean, this is a bill that, you know, the anti-Sharia bill has absolutely no law-bearing effect whatsoever. In the sense that no one in the community, no one in the Muslim community is suggesting in any way, shape, or form that we don't want to be held by the same set of laws that everyone else is being held by. It's more of a way to rile up, for whatever reasons, rile up a certain voter base. I guess it's just your typical example of a culture war, right? That there's a group of people here that are coming to change the way that we live and change, you know, change our society and change our community. And I personally attended a few city council sessions, and I spoke on the part of the Muslim community, and again on the part of many people in the general community, not just the Muslim community, that why are we inviting this bigotry and this racism in the greater scale of things?
I mean, is there really a concern in Texas among some Texans that Muslims want to introduce some kind of Quranic law to the Texas state?
What it picked up on was apparently a tribunal, which is an arbitration committee, which involves some imams, which is found within other faiths as well. The Catholics do it. The Jews do it. It's pretty common that you'll have religious arbitration, which is non-binding from a legal perspective, and that was made clear. And that was, again, their target, and that was used as a method of riling up people and a fear-mongering, that this is the proof that they're here to abuse women and stone people. And I mean, it's just absolute nonsense. So, I mean, it's not about the Sharia here. This isn't about being an anti-Sharia bill. This is about the elephant in the room, which is that, you know, this anti-religious law bill is targeting the Muslim community, and it's to stoke up the irrational fears that some people already had, that Muslims are here to take over and that they're trying to replace the Constitution with the Quran. I think it's already pretty evident in the Constitution that we're all bound by the same law.
This event and other events like it just show just how tricky and sensitive this moment is for Muslims, the whole mood right now, but also for anyone who wants to openly criticize any religion, but especially Islam. What for you does this moment mean?
You know, honestly, it's frightening. It's absolutely frightening because, you know, look, if you can tell by my accent, I don't have an accent. I'm born and raised in America. I've never known any other country. I've never lived in another country. I have lived in another country, but I've never had a passport. outside of this country. And we've had incidents. I'm from New Orleans. My wife is from Baton Rouge, where my wife has been shouted down on multiple occasions because she wears the headscarf and told to go back home, yelled out of a Walmart, intimidated on her way to her car. Unfortunately, I think that Muslim women in particular are like moving targets now for these Islamophobes. And just as it only takes one lone wolf, you know, who's been inspired by ISIS's material online to do something crazy, we've also seen that that holds true for the other side.
Omar Suleiman, a resident scholar at the Valley Ranch Islamic Center in Irving, Texas. He's also an ordained imam. Thank you very much for your thoughts.
Thank you. I appreciate you having me.
As we've heard, the Muhammad art exhibit put on by Pamela Geller of the American Freedom Defense Initiative included a contest for best caricature. And to talk about the cartoonists involved in the exhibit and the issues around depicting the prophet, I have the world's Carol Hills here in the studio with me. She's our in-house observer of satire and cartoons.
You know, I haven't been able to find out many of the names of the cartoonists who submitted. The one I was able to determine was the winner, a guy named Bosch Faustin. I don't know much about him. A quick Google search suggests he is a former Muslim raised in a moderate household, and he is sort of trying to tell the truth about Islam, according to him. His cartoon won, and we do link to it on our website. I don't know much about him.
Can you describe the winning image for us? I mean, what's going on?
We see Muhammad, and he is talking to a person drawing him. Muhammad says, "You can't draw me." And the person drawing says, "That's why I am."
All right. Charlie Hebdo is also in the news right now because recently a slew of writers have taken a political stance against the magazine. These are writers who were members of PEN, the writing organization here in the United States, free speech organization. And there was this award ceremony that they pulled out of after they found out that Charlie Hebdo was going to get this special honor. Just remind us what that story is about, Carol.
It's an annual gala sponsored by PEN USA. It happens tomorrow night. And PEN decided to give its annual Freedom of Expression Award to Charlie Hebdo. It's turned into a huge mess. More than 200 writers and members of PEN have pulled out. Others, like Salman Rushdie, are defiantly saying, look, freedom of speech is absolute. You can't split hairs. The many, many writers who oppose it, Teju Cole, Mike Golandaji, it goes on and on. They go granular by saying, the people being made fun of by Charlie Hebdo, Muslims in France, are themselves oppressed. We shouldn't be championing this.
The artist behind Doonesbury, Gary Trudeau, did he pull out of this?
I didn't see him associated with PEN, but he was accepting a George Polk Award, you know, a Lifetime Achievement Award, a couple weeks ago. And he was critical of Charlie Hebdo. And he says, satire has always comforted the afflicted while afflicting the comfortable. Because it's satire, he thinks, goes after people who themselves, you know, don't have much.
I mean, interestingly, maybe Gary Trudeau would be one of the targets of Pamela Geller, who organized the event down in Dallas by the American Freedom Defense Initiative. She was saying the media is self-enforcing a Sharia. Under the Sharia, you cannot criticize or offend Islam. But there have been media outlets that are opting not to print the cartoons. The World, the show itself, makes it a habit not to insult people. We recognize these images are central to a news story, though. And we have links to them, but they're not going to pop out if you go to PRI.org. Readers will have the choice to look or not. So to contrast that with what Ms. Geller is talking about, it's certainly not a policy to enforce Sharia here at the World, but how are news outlets generally responding to the idea that they are backing down?
Some media outlets say, oh, you know, we're not censoring, this is about editing, and others say, we don't want to offend people. It's a really tricky thing. I think it's best exemplified by the fact that Fleming Rose, the Danish editor, who himself commissioned the original Muhammad cartoons, he published a whole book this past year about that experience, and he didn't publish the Muhammad cartoons in the book. That shows you how contentious and difficult this whole subject is.
The World's Carol Hills, our in-house observer of satire and cartoons. Thank you.
You're welcome, Marco.
Coming up, hip-hop lays out the complexities of the Syrian war in rhyme and flow on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners, families, and individuals to get legal help, including incorporation, LLCs, wills, and living trusts. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman, and you're tuned to The World. Graffiti, it is universal, and no matter where you go in the world, the artists announce themselves. That little ball that rattles around the inside of a spray paint can, you know what it sounds like. But what the artists use those spray paint cans for, that will vary from country to country. Take Nicaragua. It has the highest rate of teen pregnancy in Latin America. It's also a country where there are few opportunities for poor young women. And that's the kind of thing Nicaragua's grafiteras focus on. From Managua, Sarah Van Note has our story.
Jairisa Sanchez is a grafitera, a female graffiti artist. When I first met her 3 years ago, she taught me how to hold a spray can and move my arm fluidly across a wall. She was soft-spoken yet determined, and she and her crew traveled across Nicaragua giving free workshops for girls and women. She's 23 now, and Sanchez is still painting, but she's bucking the odds. She says women here learn from a young age to expect a less adventurous life than this. You need to be the mistress of the house, she says. Take care of your husband, wash his clothes, cook for him, clean the house, and that's your life as a woman. Then Sanchez aims her bright silver can at a 20-foot concrete wall, sketching out the letters K-Y-D. Kid is her street name, and it represents her identity as a grafitera. Her life revolves around art and hip-hop. She has a day job as a graphic designer, but fills her sketchbook with colorful drawings and paints in the streets on the weekend. Today we're out in the sprawl of Managua, in a neighborhood on the edge of the polluted lake Soldán. Some teenage boys watch from the curb as Sanchez and three male artists wield paint-splattered cans in the fierce midday heat. Joel González creates interweaving, blocky white letters. Any male graffiti artist will say it fascinates him that women are also painting, he says, because we're all from the same culture. But Sanchez says when she paints with an all-women crew, people shout vulgarities at them and call them vagrants. To avoid problems, Sanchez usually gets permission to paint. Large graffiti pieces are common around Managua, which has an even older tradition of street murals. That's Juanita Bermudez, a longtime art curator. She says during the Sandinista Revolution, artists experienced a golden age. The government supported murals as art forms, and people saw them as celebratory. Graffiti is another language, she says.
Y en el caso particular de la grafitera, pues tiene más mérito aún, por lo que...
Bermudez says for women to be graffiti artists is even more remarkable because in the past it was considered a man's occupation. It's beautiful that women have the same impulse, she says, and it shows that Nicaraguan society is evolving. Sanchez is dedicated to developing her own skills and to making sure other women have the same opportunity. In 2010, she founded the Ladies Destroying Crew, a collective of young women graffiti artists. But several women who started in the crew have since dropped out. One of them is Sanchez's 17-year-old neighbor. Earlier in the day, we passed a piece by her with big, multicolored, wild-style letters. But Sanchez told me her neighbor is now home nursing her new baby, and she doesn't paint anymore. Others don't have the financial support to buy expensive supplies.
Es diferente como cuando ya eres más independiente.
When you're more independent, she says, you can get the materials you need. But once you have kids, you don't have as much time. It's not a barrier, she says, but you need to devote more time to your family. After several hours, Sanchez finishes painting, her name vibrating off the wall in green, orange, and pink 3D letters with purple tiger stripes. It stands out among the black and white designs of the male grafiteros. Now everyone will know Kid was here. For The World, I'm Sarah Van Note, Managua, Nicaragua.
9 days after a massive earthquake hit central Nepal, rescue efforts are all but over, giving way to relief and reconstruction. Foreign aid is pouring in, and while I was looking at all that, something caught my eye. The British Army has sent helicopters and military engineers. But here's the thing, those engineers are all Nepali. They're Gurkhas, members of a Nepali community with a long history of fighting for Britain. Gorkha also happens to be the Nepali region where the quake's epicenter was. So who are the Gurkhas? Who better to ask than the world's history guy, Chris Wolfe?
It all goes back to colonial times, Marco, when Britain had an Indian Empire. Brits won a war with Nepal about 200 years ago, and they were so impressed by their ferocity that part of the treaty that they imposed on Nepal, the Brits won it and took a bunch of their territory. But as a condition of the treaty, they said, okay, as long as we can recruit soldiers, because we really think they're pretty good.
But Britain lost India in the Indian subcontinent in 1947. Why are Gurkhas still serving the Queen of England?
Well, it's a good point. Actually, most of the Gurkha regiments from the old British Indian Army did indeed transfer into Indian Army service, and they still provide about 40 battalions. We're talking between 40 and 100,000 men, depending who you count. But the Brits kept four regiments, mainly because of their fighting reputation.
Are they really that special as fighters?
Yeah. They have this motto that it's better to die than live like a coward. They have this crazy 18-inch curved sword, which is kind of their symbol, a kukri. And once drawn, it has to draw blood. So you'll find a lot of Gurkhas have scarred fingers because if someone asks them to show it to them, then they have to draw blood. So they get a little nick on the finger.
They cut their own finger.
Yeah. And they win like a disproportionate amount of gallantry awards. For example, in 2010, there's this one guy, Diprasad Pun, who was awarded the second highest gallantry medal in the UK. He was at this outpost. His three buddies were wounded when they came under a Taliban attack, and he fought on by himself, used up all his ammunition, all the grenades, all the mines on the post, and then attacked using the tripod of his machine gun since he had no ammunition left.
Just like swinging it like a club.
And beat them, the last one away.
Wow. But I still don't get what's in it for them. I mean, you're basically talking about a mercenary fighting force for the Queen of England.
Right. A country so completely alien and different. How on earth does that make sense
yeah.
at all? Well, tradition, let's not underestimate the importance of that. There's a lot of family ties. A lot of guys who are Gurkhas within British service now come from families where they've been serving for generations. But the real driver, of course, is economic. Nepal is a very poor country. There are millions of Nepalis working all over the world as laborers in the Gulf. And military service is a really great way to get ahead in life. There's European levels of pay. If you get into the British service, you get a pension. You now get settlement rights in the UK, and a lot of them are filling up security jobs like nobody's business over there. And, of course, it's not just, as I said, in British service. There's thousands in the service of India, and also a big chunk of Singapore's police force is actually Gurkhas, and the Sultan of Brunei's personal bodyguard, 2,000 men, is also Gurkhas as well.
And the name Gurkha, I feel like in the coverage of the earthquake in Nepal, I've heard Gurkha as a kind of a region of the country.
Actually, where the name Gurkha comes from is really interesting. It's a little bit controversial. There's a lot of different myths out there. But what the Gurkha soldiers themselves say, you can check it on their Facebook page, is that it's not an ethnic group. They come from a variety of ethnic groups with different languages. But what their legend says is that a Gurkha is a disciple of an 8th century warrior saint, a guy called Guru Gorakhnath. We can see where the etymology comes from.
Mm-hmm.
And they gave their name to the region of Gurkha when they conquered it a few hundred years ago. And that is, unfortunately, the epicenter of the earthquake now. But the name Gurkha became associated with the royal family that united Nepal for the first time properly in the 18th century. So you can see it's kind of strongly associated with like the power traditions and warrior traditions of Nepal.
The world's history guy, Chris Wolf, thank you as always.
You're welcome, Marco.
You're listening to The World. I'm Marco Werman. Coming up on The World, a food writer shares some sage advice he got from a Tokyo sushi chef.
Use your hands, not your chopsticks, to eat my sushi.
Wow, no kidding.
When you use chopsticks, you can destroy the form because the rice starts to crumble and you start to lose the structure of the sushi.
The Ten Commandments of Sushi, that's coming up right here on The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from Lumosity, offering a 10-minute fit test to challenge memory, attention, and problem-solving. With brain games to calculate baseline scores and build a personalized brain training program, performance can be compared to global averages. Learn more at Lumosity.com. And by Fox Searchlight Pictures, presenting Far From the Madding Crowd, the new film based on Thomas Hardy's classic love story starring Carey Mulligan, Matthias Schoenaerts, Michael Sheen, and Tom Sturridge. In select theaters now.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. How would you describe Syria's four-year-old civil war? The regime of President Bashar al-Assad against the rebels, ISIS versus everyone? As conclusions, those are both too simple, as this Syrian-American rapper reminds us.
Now they say Syria's confusing. Can't decide which of the sides they really should be choosing.
We'll hear more from him in just a few minutes. First, though, let's get a reality check on the conflict from Josh Landis. He used to live in Syria and is now director of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Landis believes the tide of the conflict appears to be turning against Assad. And for Landis, the reasons are pretty clear.
It looks like, finally, the Syrian Islamic rebels are beginning to unify. And they're under the leadership of both al-Qaeda, the Nusra group, that's al-Qaeda's wing in Syria, and Ahrar al-Sham, a part of this big Islamic front. And these two militias have come together, and they look seem to be sponsored by Turkey and Saudi Arabia. And this is very important because the sponsors of these groups, the people who are funding and arming them, are finally getting on the same page. And that's largely due to King Salman in Saudi Arabia. We have a new Saudi king who is really fired up about fighting the Iranians, and he wants to get rid of Assad, it seems. That seems to be the message we're getting out of Turkey and Saudi Arabia.
So where does ISIS actually fit into this better organized opposition, Josh?
Well, ISIS owns a third of Syria. It was the major opposition group. In some ways, the fact the United States is bombing it is good for the thousand other rebel factions, because ISIS and these other rebel factions were fighting over territory in the north. And so the rebels had been pinned down by this growing ISIS state that was moving into their territory. The fact that America has pinned down ISIS, sucked many of their fighters into Iraq to fight the Battle of Tikrit and other places by firing up the Iraqi regime, means that in Syria, ISIS is relatively weak. And the other rebel groups have used this to get together and go on the offensive against Assad.
So if Assad is weakening, what happens next? I know it's totally speculative, but the Turks and Saudis interested maybe pushing for some kind of accommodation. Is that a possibility, or do you see a demand for total victory?
I do see a demand for total victory. The rebels are want Damascus. They want the coast. They do not want an ethnic enclave for Alawites. So Assad has shown complete inability to reform his system and to compromise in any way. What he can do is shrink his area of governance. He's done that. He's lost more than half of Syria already. Some people would like to, many Alawites are beginning to think, we just want an Alawite enclave on the coast where Alawites are majority. The problem is it would be very hard to defend that on the coast. If the Syrian army under Assad, the Assad army, begins to fail, there's going to be a drive by the rebels to go straight to the coast. That could lead to millions more refugees flowing out of Syria, particularly the Alawites. The Christians are mostly gone. But it's a bloody story where both sides seem to want complete victory.
I mean, having lived in Syria for years, Josh, and your wife's family is from there, that sounds like that could be your family's worst nightmare.
It is. And we've just on the phone talking about what to do with a brother of my wife who still lives in Syria. He's trying to start a little farm. He lost his business when sanctions were put on a business that provided T-shirts and jeans to French department stores. But all Syrians have been doing this for the last 5 years. Almost half of Syrians have been displaced from their homes. And so everybody's trying to figure out what to do. The country has been reduced to rubble. 90% of Syrians, according to the UN, live below the poverty line today. So it's been a story of constant anxiety for Syrians. And those who haven't lost their homes already are really quite lucky.
Josh Landis is the director of Middle East Studies at the University of Oklahoma. The war in Syria weighs heavily on many Syrian Americans, people like Omar Effendim. He raps about the conflict, as we'll hear in just a bit. But as Omar himself will tell you, he's a man who wears many hats.
I am a Syrian American hip-hop artist, designer, poet, peace activist. So like you said, I wear a number of different hats. I was born in Saudi Arabia, raised in Washington, D.C., and I've been living in Los Angeles for the last 10 years.
Right. So you grew up in the U.S., in Washington.
Yeah.
I gather you went to UVA, and it was kind of there where you first started.
That's right.
Kind of performing. But did you discover rap before that and
Absolutely.
Kind of had that as a goal at some point?
Well, I don't know if it was really a goal prior to going to UVA. It was something that I loved. I grew up listening to. I kind of engaged with it at a time that I was also studying Arabic poetry pretty heavily. It's the backbone of the Arabic language, so you kind of study it whenever you study the language. And I found parallels between it and the hip-hop music that I was listening to, just in terms of the themes that people were kind of addressing when they were talking about their loved ones or about loss or about even simply battle poetry, like who's the iller MC, if you will. And so that always felt like something I could connect with. And when I got into college, it was kind of the first time I had the opportunity to get on stage, perform, participate in open mics, even make beats, things like that.
So taking these two parallel tracks and you kind of like bring them together, what were you kind of rapping about at first? What drew your attention
Well, I guess early on, the kinds of things that any college kid would rap about, everything from partying and smoking and doing whatever you might do in college. But I also kind of knew that I had an opportunity to address some pretty bigger issues that were, you know, important to me, important to my community.
Issues like what?
Well, political issues, sociopolitical issues, America's involvement in the Middle East, what it was like growing up as a Muslim and Arab in the West, you know, all these things. And then halfway through my college career, 9/11 happened, and that just kind of got amplified. And it became this sort of microscope that people were kind of watching me through. And all of a sudden, I realized, you know, if I am going to have people's extra attention, I might as well do some good with it.
So let's talk about what they're hearing in your music, the people who are listening to you. You have this, your debut album in 2010 was called Siriana Americana.
Mm-hmm.
Pronouncing that right?
Yeah.
That was before the Arab Spring, though, right? 2010.
It was, yeah.
You have a song, Destiny, on that album, and there's a line, it's hard living in the West when you know the East has got the best of me. Let's hear the song.
قضاء وقدر يا حبيبي It's hard living in the west when I know the east got the best of me Could be looking in my eyes but you never really see the rest of me now Can you hear me my city? Bilingual's what I'm blessed to be here حمام السلام افتحي اجنحتك يطير
So we hear the chorus going, destiny, destiny. What is this song about? Is it about your destiny?
Yeah, I think my destiny, but also just the destiny of kind of immigrants in general who kind of find themselves in new surroundings and new environments, especially this kind of second generation immigrants. You know, I came at a very young age. And so while I do identify as Syrian and as Arab and as Muslim and all these things, I also very much identify as an American. It's something that a lot of folks have latched onto in that regard. I've even seen it printed on T-shirts and bracelets, and like, it's pretty amazing how you can write something in your bedroom that's so personal to you, but then can resonate with, you know, hundreds of thousands of people around the world.
Right. So, 2011, the Arab Spring happens.
Mm-hmm.
It's a big change for a number of countries, and for Syria, where your family comes from, mm-hmm. it really hasn't ended, and in fact, it's just gotten worse, and the change is really miserable and quite violent.
Mm.
Did that refocus your attention in terms of theme in your music?
I mean, in the beginning of the Arab Spring, quote unquote, I think there was a lot of hope and idealism and euphoria surrounding these revolutions. And we were kind of pushing back against the fatalism of our parents' generation. And I remember even then, like, a lot of our parents' generation saying, you know what, just give it some time. You know, the way that things go in the Middle East, don't get too hopeful. And we were like, oh, no, come on, things are different. Things have changed. And 4 years later, you kind of understand where they're coming from now, especially where it seems like in a lot of places where there was so much change in the beginning, it's kind of regressed. And so it took me a while to kind of find where I was at with all of that, you know, and I'd planned on releasing an album a couple years ago that kind of embodied a lot of that hope. But as things kind of started to devolve, it gave me some pause and it made me realize I need to kind of collect myself and figure out exactly where we stand right now. And
the sense of fatalism, though, that, you know, things take a long time to change. I mean, while we're thinking about that fatalism, there are lots of people dying in Syria and, you know, millions of people on the move. Does it let us off the hook?
Absolutely not. I mean, apathy is not an option. And I think we have privilege here. And I try to recognize that as a kind of a sense of responsibility. My focus is kind of to just remind people that beneath all the political posturing, beneath all the conspiracy theories and all the proxy wars that are taking place, there's very real human suffering.
Omar Efendim, I'd like us to go out with a rap that you wrote not so long ago. It's called Crying Shame. It is about Syria and what's been going on there. We've got the beat track in the background all queued up. So let me thank you, first of all, for coming in and speaking with me. And just tell me just a quick line or two on Crying Shame.
Crying Shame is just, you know, more of an honest reflection of where we're at 4 years later when it comes to Syria, and something that I think people can relate to more sincerely now that we kind of understand where we're at.
Now they say Syria's confusing. Can't decide which of the sides they really should be choosing. Here's a thought. How about you recognize that we're all losing and there's nothing civil about a war where kids are stabbed to death and mothers smothered on a kitchen floor or by the kitchen floor. Collapsing from a barrel bomb, conspiracies we've carried on like baggage from our colonizers, unified by our ability to seek the wrong advisors.
We have exclusive video of Syrian American Omar Efendim rapping that entire tune for us. His performance of Crying Shame there, you can see it at PRI.org.
or punchlines. Come on, man, 2 for 1. I'm not amused. They yell, somebody tell these anchormen it's best to keep it classy. Burgundy's the color of our blood that's flooding in the Isle. Civil disobedience flowed within our veins.
So Columbus got a pretty big send-off when he left Spain for the New World. But the story of the first person to head to the U.S. from a small town in El Salvador makes you wonder why he's celebrated. That first migrant's departure started an exodus from Intupucá, and yet the town built a monument in his honor. Roxandra Guidi went to Intupucá to find out why.
Mayor Enrique Méndez gives his theory as to why people started leaving en masse for the U.S.
Debido al conflicto armado que se dio, ¿verdad? Entonces la gente comenzó a irse.
Immigration started because of the armed conflict here in El Salvador, and the first to go was Sigfredo Chavez.
But it turns out that, like many other stories told in this town, the gossip, the legends, Mayor Méndez's version isn't entirely accurate. Migration from Intipucá started in the late 1960s, at least 15 years before El Salvador descended into civil war. And as the mayor speaks, some of his staff disagrees with him over whether Sigfredo Chavez traveled north alone or not. One person who claims to know the real story is Oscar Romero, Sigfredo Chavez's nephew. I meet him in front of the monument erected in his uncle's honor in Intipucá's main plaza.
Y el monumento es el primer monumento al emigrante a nivel.
It's the first monument to immigrants in the world. So my uncle now is an international symbol.
This might be an exaggeration, but he's definitely a folk hero here in Intipucá. Romero points at the clay statue of his uncle carrying a backpack.
Tiene un cuerpo delgado, atlético.
He's fit and athletic. You see his character traits on his face, confident, driven. He's headed north, in the direction of the airport.
Romero says his uncle left town in 1968 with a tourist visa for the U.S. According to the story, his mother pushed him to go to the States to improve the family's fortunes. He went to Washington, D.C., and a few months later, stories started trickling back, that it was easy to make a good living doing dishes and cleaning homes. Within a couple of years, local legend says about 300 people a day were leaving for the States. Again, an exaggeration. Soon, Intipuqueños living in Washington started sending money home. Eventually, remittances paid for a school, a cultural center, a stadium. So the issue of who was the first migrant meant bragging rights.
It's like a prize. It's like saying, I want to win this prize because my family was the first to migrate.
Jacqueline Portillo is the director of the Cultural Center. She says three different families now claim that their ancestor is the first real migrant. Portillo shows me one of Chavez's old passports, his divorce papers, old photos.
The Chavez family kept better documentation than the family of another migrant, Alfredito Arias. So there's just more weight to the story of Chavez being the first migrant.
Alfredito Arias insists he was the first to leave. Sigfredo Chavez died in 2006. But his widow, Elba Salinas, is living in the U.S. And her nephew, Hugo Salinas, says Chavez wouldn't have left for the States if it weren't for her.
Se fue con Elba.
He left with Elba. Elba told me so.
Her nephew is invested in collecting the details of her story and the others as well. He's planning a big event for the 50th anniversary of migration in Intipucá, coming up in 2018.
I wanted to create a positive image of my town because no one was collecting these personal stories, like the one of Mr. Martin Lasso, who would lend you a suit to get on a flight because you had to dress nicely back then, or the story of travel today, pay me later, which would give you a loan so you could pay for your U.S. visa.
Salinas worries these stories will be forgotten. Today, an estimated half of the town's population is currently living in the States. Vendors try to hawk their wares by driving around town, but there are too few takers. The streets are largely empty, except for the kids who run around the statue of Sigfredo Chavez in Migrants Park. For The World, I'm Roxandra Guidi, Intipucá, El Salvador.
Roxandra's story was produced in association with Round Earth Media. You're listening to The World.
Support for PRI's The World comes from LegalZoom, for over 10 years providing solutions for business owners to get legal help, including corporate filings and legal plans featuring attorney contract review and tax advice. Legal help is at LegalZoom.com.
I'm Marco Werman with The World. If lifting a five-day curfew is a sign of normalcy, okay, it looks like Baltimore is returning to normal. Normal is a relative term, though, when it comes to race issues. Just ask the Ethiopian Jews in Israel. For years, they've known what being on the bottom rung of society means. But it wasn't until last week when an Ethiopian Israeli soldier was allegedly assaulted by Israeli police that their complaints really got pushed into the open. The incident has also sparked protests in Israel against police brutality. I asked reporter Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem to describe what happened.
A young Ethiopian Israeli soldier was walking down the street. A police officer stopped him and then beat him up while he arrested him. It was seemingly unprovoked. At least that's the impression you get when you watch the video footage. It was something that the Israeli prime minister said he was shocked when he saw this video. And that's what sparked all these protests.
Is that kind of thing typical with Ethiopian Jews? I imagine it's not typical at all with a soldier.
Yes, I think that's one of the reasons why the prime minister said he was so shocked, because Israeli soldiers are treated with utmost respect here. For Ethiopian Israelis, they say this is no surprise to them and no shock. They talk about experiencing this kind of discrimination across the board. We have seen in the past couple of decades different protests Ethiopian Israelis have mounted, but this is really the biggest one ever.
For non-Ethiopian Israelis, what's been their reaction?
In Israel, across the board, there's support for Ethiopian Israelis. They're seen as one of everybody. And more than anything, they're seen as a symbol, you know.
Remind us who the Ethiopian Jews are and how they ended up in Israel in the first place.
Yeah, they say that they descend from one of the lost tribes of Israel. It's a Jewish community that was cut off from the rest of the Jewish world for centuries. Many were airlifted to Israel in secret Mossad operations starting 30 years ago. So they're a small minority, but they're really at the bottom rung of society here. They always struggle to adapt to Israel, and they complain of all kinds of discrimination.
The alleged police abuse has uncomfortable echoes of the situation black men in the U.S. have been facing for years, and which has been now captured in events from Ferguson to Baltimore in the past year. You grew up not far from Ferguson. Where do you think the similarities fall apart?
If you're looking at the differences, in the U.S., race relations have been an ongoing open wound. Here in Israel, the struggles that Ethiopian Jews face has been a much more subdued issue. Issues of discrimination are not really discussed in the media here in much detail, but it's part of Israel's larger story. It's a country of immigrants. Each new group of immigrants look down upon the previous group of immigrants. It's the nature of immigrant societies.
Has this case in Israel at least started a public conversation about race there?
It has. I was at one of the protests a couple nights ago. I spoke to some of the Ethiopian-Israeli protesters who mentioned Baltimore, said that they were inspired by protesters in Baltimore. A lot of them carried signs saying the police who beat up the soldier should be put behind bars. A lot of them talked about how they fight for Israel in the army. They feel they give their lives for this country. And as one of them told me, Israel sees our blood as only good for being spilt on the battlefield. And there's a real feeling here that after 30 years of Ethiopian Israelis in this country, the young people are rising up and speaking volumes.
Reporter Daniel Estrin speaking with me from Jerusalem. Thank you so much.
Thanks, Marco.
If you have questions about how the situation for Ethiopian Jews in Israel relates to the Black Lives Matter protests here in the U.S., you can ask Ethiopian-American author Maza Mengiste. She is on our Facebook page right now, so ask away at facebook.com/PRI the world. Questioning authority can be a good thing, but I wouldn't try it at Yajima Sushi. It's a small restaurant in Tokyo that writer Tom Downey visited recently. Inside, the chef demands that you eat by his rules. He calls them his Ten Commandments of sushi. Here's how Tom Downey remembers the place.
It's a very small basement restaurant near a big, bustling Tokyo subway station or train station called Shibuya. But it's the kind of place that you could easily miss if you didn't know about it beforehand and if you weren't aware that down in this basement was this kind of incredible little world of a sushi chef and his wife and a few little customers arrayed around their counter. One of the things that struck me immediately, having eaten at a lot of other sushi restaurants when I entered Yajima Sushi, was that Yajima-san, the chef, was really in control and command of the place, like almost nowhere else that I had visited. So he had me wait, and then finally he sat me down in front of him and started to serve me sushi and pieces of sushi in rapid succession, one at a time, but telling me, eat it right now, don't wait. Which leads me to Yajima-san's first commandment of sushi, which is that a full meal of sushi should take just 10 to 15 minutes. And in order to explain that to me, he placed a piece of squid sushi in front of me, and he started counting. 1, 2, 3. And said to me that each second that passes without me eating the sushi means that the sushi declines. First of all, the fish is warm. Second of all, the rice and the fish start to intermingle. And if you leave it there for a while, it becomes soggy in the same way that a sandwich would become soggy. Moving ahead to Yajima's fifth commandment, which is use your hands, not your chopsticks, to eat my sushi. One of the things that struck me, again, when I first visited Yajima, was that he told me to put the chopsticks down right away, as soon as I went for the chopsticks and as soon as he placed a piece of sushi before me. And he told me to use my hands. This is something you see people occasionally doing in Japan, not as much here, but it was always an optional thing. Some people like to eat sushi that way. And I also always imagined it was a somewhat rougher way of eating sushi. He had a different interpretation and a different argument for why you should do that, which was that the pieces of sushi are incredibly delicate. And when you use chopsticks, you can destroy the form because the rice starts to crumble and you start to lose the structure of the sushi. Whereas when you pick it up with your hands, you can kind of cradle the rice at the bottom and you can get the whole thing into your mouth without destroying the form and the beauty of the piece of sushi. On that first visit to Yajima, where he had me sit down for a little while and then called me to the seat at the counter, I realized that part of what's going on in his restaurant is that he wants you to sit down at the counter at the moment when he is ready to serve you completely, serve you all your sushi in succession. And at the moment then, when you can focus totally and completely on the sushi in front of you and on nothing else. So one of the sort of humorous manifestations of this is that he really does not like people talking when they're at his sushiya. He believes that you should come in there, you should sit down, and for the 10 or 15 minutes that he's serving you sushi, the only thing that you should focus on is the sushi. That's Yajima's ninth commandment, which is savor my sushi, but don't chit-chat.
All right, your command is my obey. Writer Tom Downey there sharing the 10 commandments of sushi with us. I wonder if Yajima has them written on stone tablets. You can find out what Yajima-san's other commandments are and hear Tom tell us when sushi restaurants really took off in the West. Just go to PRI.org. From the Nan and Bill Harris studios at WGBH here in Boston, I'm Marco Werman. We'll be back with you tomorrow.
The World is a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH, supported by Nan and Bill Harris, committed to supporting objective, unbiased reporting on national and international issues. The PRI Trust for Innovation, which enables informed risk-taking in the creation of new content for public radio. Donors include the Tagney-Jones Family Fund and the Rose Family Fund. By the Skoll Foundation, supporting innovative solutions to the world's most pressing problems with the Skoll Award for Social Entrepreneurship. More information available at skoll.org. By the PRI Ambassador Council, whose members include Catherine Harris and the Hegart Foundation, John and Caroline Ballantyne, Blythe Brendan Mann Foundation, and Michael V. and Ann Cerisi. And by the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives. GatesFoundation.org.
PRI, Public Radio International.